Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a Dame Commander of the British Empire, earned for her services to writing. With a plethora of books under her belt, she's been shortlisted for the Booker Prize and won countless awards, including the Whitbread Novel of the Year Award and the Orange Prize for Fiction. As well as being a writer, she was formerly the Chancellor of the University of East Anglia, an institution with a great literary tradition. Her latest novel is Islands of Mercy. Rose Tremaine, welcome to Meet the Writers. Rose, I want to go back into your early life because from all accounts, it wasn't particularly happy. Your parents were really rather emotionally absent.
I think it was very difficult for that generation. I mean, my father was in the war and then he came back, and I think they felt that they needed some kind of reward for the sufferings they'd been through during the war, and they sort of didn't want to have children around. I mean, a lot of my contemporaries, I think, have suffered in the same way, that they wanted to have a good time. They wanted to see friends. They wanted to dance. They were still quite young, and they didn't want to be burdened with their children. And so my sister and I were very neglected by them.
But you did have a wonderful nanny.
We had a wonderful nanny, and I thought, I mean, this is rather a sentimental thing to say, but I have thought in my adult life that she probably saved me from becoming a rather hard-hearted kind of person. I mean, she was a hard nanny. We're not talking about my grandmother. Mm. We're talking about a hard nanny. And we just happened upon somebody who had a huge generosity of heart and was able to show me and my sister great love. And she was with us until I left for boarding school at the age of 11.
Your father was a writer.
He was a playwright, and there was a kind of sadness in this career. We grew up with the idea that writing was a very honourable thing to do. He had a little study in our house in London, and we always had to be quiet when Dad was working, etc., etc. And then his plays, they got to provincial theatres, and I remember when I was about 10, in fact, just before he abandoned the family, there was a play of his that was going to come into London, and there was great excitement about that. And then the actress who was going to star in it decided to accept a film part, and so the play didn't happen. I think that was a huge disappointment to him. So it was a career that kind of stalled. I didn't know him very well, Georgina, so how affected he was by this, the fact that the thing that he wanted to do most didn't exactly work, I don't really know. I mean, in some later years, he tried a novel, and that didn't work tremendously well either. So there was this peculiar ambiguity attaching to the act of writing.
Now, as you say, he walked out when you were, what, about 10?
I was 10, yes. And my sister was 14. And it seemed to me that, I mean, I'm sure it did take longer because things concertina, don't they? When you're older, you look back on childhood. It seems to me that this happened sort of from one day to the next. One day he was there and then the next day he was gone. And we kept asking, when was he coming back, and not being told. These are the times, we're talking about the 1950s here, when grown-ups weren't, I think, as nearly as honest with their children as they are today. And both Nan and my mother said, oh, we don't know, he'll be back soon. And then, of course, he never came back.
Mm. How did it affect your mother?
She had a breakdown. We were saved after about a year because she met she fell in love with somebody that they already knew, she and my father knew, somebody called Ivo Thompson, who married her, and he had children of his own. He had two children, and we moved out of London. He bought us a house in Berkshire, and he put these two families together, and he was extraordinarily kind. So he was, in a way, the second person that sort of saved us, because he was a kind and jovial person, whereas my father had been clever and slightly morose. Ivo Thompson was very kind, not as clever as my dad, but an extraordinarily honourable man, really.
But it did mean, of course, that you and your sister went off to boarding school, which wasn't a happy experience.
Oh, God, yes. Never do that to your children. I was all right in the end at boarding school because I found things to do. The first year was terrible because I seem to have lost so much. I'd lost my father, I'd also lost our London home and my friends, and most terrible of all, really, was I'd lost Nan. Nan was no longer with us. So my first term at boarding school was very, very unhappy. But I found friends and I found things to do, and it was there that I started writing. So I was all right at that school in the end.
Mm. Tell us about that first spark, that inclination to write.
Do you know, I think it sort of always was there. I mean, I look back even to the times before I went to boarding school, and I can remember that my sister was a very good artist, and we had this wonderful little child's collaboration whereby I would write stories and she would do adorable little illustrations to them. When I look back on it now, I can remember her illustrations. I remember in particular we had one which was called The Bear Who Went to Sea. And I can see this little bear now. It was probably a kind of slightly derivative from Rupert Bear, which was a Daily Express cartoon. But her drawings were very good, and he had lots of adventures, this bear, I can't remember what. So, yes, I'd sort of started then, this was before school. And then what I found at the boarding school, and this perhaps is significant, that to write about people who were completely unlike me, either made-up people or people like, I don't know, clowns or chimney sweeps or mermaids, people who were completely outside my own experience, was a very effective way of escaping from my own world into something that I found more bearable and indeed very interesting and sometimes funny.
Mm. So give us the timeline. You left school and then what happened?
We moved out of London, and that very same year I was sent to this to the boarding school, to Crofton Grange. And I was there until 1959, but I was only 16 and I wanted to stay on. I had a very wonderful English teacher who had high hopes of kind of helping me get towards Oxford, which I think I'm probably not boasting when I say that I think I could have done that. But my mother, she had other ideas. She had a Philistine heart, and she didn't think that the intellectual life was very important. She kept on using this word blue-stocking in relation to Oxford. So I was taken away from the school and I was sent to learn French at a girls' school in Switzerland. And I owe that something in that I did learn, I followed that with a year in Paris, and so at a young age I learned to speak very good French. But I missed out on the Oxford route, and so after Paris and all that, I had to come back to London, retake A-levels, and then get myself to university, by which time kind of Oxford had gone out the door, and that's when I wound up at the University of East Anglia.
And, of course, you had a long association with it, and it has one of the best literary programmes in the country.
Well, it certainly did. I mean, I don't know how good it is anymore. I don't really have a connection with it anymore. And, of course, there are 150 courses now. Yeah. And what we loved about being part of that in the early days was for a long while, it was the only one. Ian McEwan was its very first student. It was run by Malcolm Bradbury and Angus Wilson. And I think they used to meet in the Maidshead pub in Norwich and have sort of discussion sessions there. And it went from there. Both Angus Wilson and Malcolm Bradbury had taught at the Creative Writing School in Iowa, and they had come back with the idea that just as you can teach actors to be better actors and musicians and so forth, that you could do the same thing with writers, that you could lay upon their gift a kind of professional, a lot of professional help. You could guide them towards something that they might not otherwise have been able to do. And then it kind of just went from there, that it was then established into a proper MA course on which I taught later on.
Mm. You were first published in 1976, I think, where that was Sadler's birthday. Tell us about the route to publication.
Well, it was quite arduous. I remember finishing this novel. I mean, when you write a first novel, as I'm sure you can imagine, I mean, you really don't know. I was 29 or something. In my case, anyway, I didn't really know what I was doing or if what I had written was any good. But I found an agent rather fast. I found Richard Scott Simon, who was a wonderful agent, alas, no longer with us. But he took me on, and I remember I was going on holiday, and he said, oh, well, you know, off you go to France or wherever it was. And he said, when you come back, I will have found you a publisher. So I went off on this holiday with great joy in my heart. And when I came back, there was no publisher. In fact, that book was rejected by 6 publishers, including various publishers that I've now been with for a long time. But it landed miraculously on the desk of somebody called Penelope Hall, who was then at McDonald and Jane's. And I think she saw a great... I don't think it's a very accomplished novel, but she saw a great promise in it. And I think perhaps in a kind of miraculous way, she had this image of... which went on down the road of us working together over a long, long period of time. She moved to various different houses and I followed her. And we were editor and author for 40 years until she died in 2017.
How important is that relationship? Obviously it is on a personal level, but how reliant is a writer on their editor?
I think it's very important in relation to the first draft of a book. What I like to do, really, is not show anybody anything much, maybe a few pages. I sometimes, now, I show a few pages to Richard Holmes, my partner, and indeed to my now agent, Caroline Michelle. So Caroline and Richard see, perhaps, you know, some parts of what I'm doing. But then, when I get to the end of a first draft, which is never right, and this is something I used to say to my students, and they looked at me with great grief in their eyes when I said this, but I always said to them, don't believe that your first draft is right. You know, let it sit, let it stand, let it drain. Talk to other people about it. Have some people you trust read it. And then do a second draft. And it's in the second draft that you get to where you're going, I think.
Mm. And your editor helps with that.
And, well, yes, well, sorry, that was your question. I had a fantastic relationship with Penny. And she used to come up here to my house in Norfolk, in fact, exactly where I'm sitting now. She always sat in the same chair and looked out at the garden. And we used to spend a couple of days literally going through my first draft. And then, if necessary, we'd go through the second draft in the same way. She was infinitely patient, and she was very, very enthusiastic about my work, but she was very, very sort of stern and headmistressy about it. She said, we've seen that, haven't we? We don't need to hear that again, or this goes on too long, or not long enough. You know, she had always a very direct way of telling me what was wrong, and we had many laughs over that. But I think, like 90% of the time, she was right about what was wrong. But she, like lawyers who say they should never ask a question until they know the answer to it, Penny was the same. She would say, what are we going to do with this section which isn't quite working? She would have an answer, or she would propose something that would help me then to go away and make it better.
Mm. And your books just kept getting better and better. In 1989, wasn't it? Restoration was nominated for the Booker Prize. How did your parents react to that success?
Well, I was not in touch with my father. My father just disappeared from our lives and never really reappeared. I saw him about twice in my adult life. He made a new marriage and had a new family. And I think, like perhaps many men of that generation, or perhaps of all generations, they make a second family, and the old family kind of, I don't know, just withers. And he wasn't interested in us, and neither in me or my sister. But he certainly wasn't really interested in my being a writer. In fact, I think he felt probably quite envious of it because his own career hadn't been what he wanted. My mother tried very hard to understand what I was doing, and she found it slightly weird. I think my books are quite sort of emotionally explicit, and the stories are quite, I don't know what you might call them, quite dangerous, perhaps, you know. There's a lot of strong feeling. There's a certain amount of sort of sexual entrapment and violence and things going on in them, which my mother couldn't really bear to think about. So I think she saw them as sort of not really belonging to me, exactly. Hmm. And she couldn't retain them. I mean, I'd give her stuff to read, obviously, and then she'd forget it, like, 2 weeks later.
Hmm. Restoration, as well as being nominated for the book, have also got your reputation as a historical novelist. Is that something that you would subscribe to?
Well, I think it's something that I'm stuck with, really, because a lot of my books have been set in the past. My feeling about what the past can do is, paradoxically, it can seem very fresh, because the process of writing and then publishing a novel is long, and it's, you know, it's at minimum 2 years. And as you know, you and I know very well, contemporary life moves so fast that it's very hard for novelists to seize the contemporary in a way that when the book comes out, it's not already sort of quasi-historical, because things are changing so fast. The technology is changing, the way the things that people find important are changing, the politics are changing, everything's changing all the time. And if you locate something in the past, I think perhaps you have greater access to the more sort of, you know, the big themes, the big universal themes of, you know, love, death, longing, desertion, mm-hmm. all those things. So that's what's drawn me to the historical novel. But it's not a desire to escape from what we're feeling now. It's a desire to put it in another context where it actually talks to people, but it talks to them perhaps in a slightly different way, and they're not looking in a sort of nitpicky way for what's either right or wrong about the present.
Restoration missed out on the Booker Prize. Kazuo Ishiguro won it that year. But I wonder, because I know you've also judged the prize a couple of times, if that changes the way you write now that you know what the criteria is.
Oh, no, absolutely not. No. No, I think you have to put on a totally other hat to be a judge. You know, you just have to take what is before you and see where the power or not of those books lie. I don't think it alters the way that I write in any sense. And I think this would be a mad situation if writers were writing in order to sort of second-guess the winning of a prize. You have to write what you feel passionately about, what you care about, what's troubling you, what needs looking at. It's like I always say that in my own case, that I sort of write to learn rather than write to teach. I think perhaps some writers want to tell people things and want to tell them how to do it, but my writing is a journey of discovery in each case, and I feel that I want to learn something new each time. And I certainly don't write with any specific prize in mind.
No. And you haven't previously, until your autobiography in 2018, really written anything that could be seen to be autobiographical, although does much of your work draw on your own life? I'm thinking of the mothers, perhaps, in the Gustav Sonata or maybe Sacred
Country.
The cruel
mothers, yes. I think, there are a couple of cruel mothers. They're cruel in a worse way than my mother was. My mother was sort of cruel by default, whereas the mother in the Gustav Sonata, who is a very wounded person, is almost, one feels, deliberately cruel, deliberately neglectful. And I think that was not the case with my own mother. So I think maybe I've drawn a little bit on her, but I've also perhaps drawn on Nan for some of the kindly people in my fiction, the kindly older women in my fiction, and possibly on my stepfather. For instance, in Sacred Country, there's a very kind, avuncular grandfather who tries very hard to understand something which is, in its real essence, is completely beyond him, but in a very generous way he tries to understand it. And my stepfather was somebody like that. So they're not there directly. I haven't given any of my fictional characters real sort of physical or direct characteristics from my family. But, yeah, I mean, we're all the product of, you know, the things that have happened to us, aren't we? So there's a lot of myself in the fiction, but I couldn't tell you where it is quite. It's just in my way of thinking and my desire to go to the heart of things. I think this was slightly provoking to my mother, but I always wanted to argue things. I wanted to try to get to the truth of stuff that was being told me when I was a kid, and she'd say things like, oh well, we don't want to talk about that, or let's not worry about that. And I think that's what has really kept me writing, this desire to kind of get to the truth of the subject that I'm...
You've tackled some subjects, and way before their time. I mean, Sacred Country, transsexuality comes up in that. You've got immigration in The Road Home. I mean, that was your Orange Prize-winning book.
Yes, I know. It's interesting, the question of, you know, authenticity, I think, would now come... Whether I could write I mean, I adored writing Sacred Country. This is in 19, it was published in 93, so I wrote it in 92. And it's about a little girl who believes she's not a girl, believes she's a boy. And it's about her long struggles to change gender. And I remember when I was writing this book and telling people, you know, what it was about, they said, oh, why are you writing about something so marginal? You know, this is a tiny, tiny percentage of the population. What's interesting in that? And I said, well, I think it is very interesting because it's one of the last mysteries. We don't quite know why this happens, but yet it is something which carries with it the most powerful conviction, which never goes away. And I was really interested in that. But I think that if I said to my publisher now, okay, I want to write a novel both in the voice of and around the idea of gender change, they would say, no, you can't do it. You haven't got the right. We live in an age where it worries me this, that it's sort of almost by extended logic, we'll only be able to write about things that have happened to us as opposed to things which have happened to other people. And I think there's a great problem with that.
Absolutely. People seem to miss the fact that writing is about, or fiction is about, making up stuff. You don't
have to empathy, be. Yeah, and empathy. Yeah. You know, what is it? I mean, my first novel, written when I was 29, was about an elderly man. Now, I mean, I had some examples, you know, my grandfather and one or two of his friends and so on. I knew how elderly men behaved a bit, but I didn't know inside their souls. And yet, I think I managed to get inside the soul of this person. And I think I without being at all boastful about it, but slightly backed up by Peter Tatchell, who wrote a very nice introduction to the new edition of Sacred Country, I think I did manage to get inside the soul of Mary Ward, who becomes Martin.
As you have done with Jane, so there's no question that you're not a very tall woman who lives in Bath in 1865. But Islands of Mercy is your new book, and I found it absolutely magnificent because it was just completely unexpected. For one thing, it's tremendously erotic in a very tasteful way.
Well, yes, I think it needed to be. I mean, this is a young woman who has an innate gift. Her father's a surgeon, she's a nurse, and it turns out that she's a very wonderful nurse, almost sort of mesmerically gifted with healing powers. But she's not happy in her life. She feels that there's something else, other things down the road are waiting for her. And one of these turns out to be the fact that she loves women, and in particular she meets a very beautiful young Italian woman called Giulietta, and they have indeed a very erotic love affair which takes them to Paris, and they behave for the times, we're talking about 1865, Victorian era, they behave in a slightly outrageous way for the times. But I hope this will kind of inspire and abuse readers, and that they will come out rather loving my character Jane. Mm. But of course, one can't anticipate that either. They might think that actually she's a rather promiscuous nuisance.
Oh, I absolutely loved her. I thought she was fantastic. There's a late marriage in there. And of course, one could see that echoing your life too. You had two previous marriages before moving in with your current partner, Richard Holmes. And I found it interesting too that your heroine's called Jane, as was your mother.
Yes, somebody else said to me the other day, oh, was this, you know, was this a kind of revenge, you know, to create somebody who's completely unlike my mother, who never had any adventures of that kind? No, I think what I loved about the name Jane was its one-syllable simplicity. Mm. And what my character Jane feels is that everything... It's sort of a bit like my own feelings, but she feels it more powerfully, that everything should be plain and truthful, and that if what happens to her is that she falls in love with a young woman, that she should indulge in that she should go forward. She should not deny her own truth. She should go forward and, you know, see what that brings to her life, to both their lives. So I'm not quite sure that there is any connection with my mother, unless sort of, you know, completely by default, in creating somebody who is very, very unlike her.
And there's this wonderful character of her aunt, too, who's just this bohemian, living this extraordinary life. She's a painter.
She's a painter, and what I was very keen to explore there, this book is a series of quite unhappy love affairs in it, as well as some ones that work out. And this character, Jane's aunt, the painter, Emmeline, has had a very unhappy early love affair and sort of never got over it, so that she's put all the kind of pent-up emotion, longing, expectation, willingness to discover the world in a new way. She's put all that into her art, and she gets great satisfaction from that. But she's been lonely, and she warns Jane, you know, don't have my life, because it's been too lonely. There's just been me and friends. Of course, she's rather beautiful and popular, so she's got friends, but she's a solitary person, and she warns Jane about this. And that leads to all kinds of complications, because at one point in the narrative, Jane thinks that she adores her aunt. She has no mother. Her mother's died. And she thinks that perhaps she'd better heed this and get married. And she makes a decision to marry somebody, and it's all wrong, like it's often wrong in a Jane Austen novel.
Mm. It goes off to Borneo, then, which is a sort of startling development, and suddenly we're on this island, and Sir Ralph Savage is there. He's the sort of Raja of the island, and it's just, again, wonderfully evocative. We feel the jungle, we smell the smells, we empathise with this very odd man.
Yes, I suppose he's odd. I mean, I wanted there to be a connection between him and Jane. I mean, I'm not sure the readers will necessarily pick this up, but I chose two absolutely contrasting locations. Bath, which is at that time, you know, very sort of smart and very, very genteel and very orderly. And then in absolute contrast to that, we go to the island of Borneo. What takes us there is we're following several stories in this book, one of which is the story of a young naturalist who is trying to follow in the footsteps of his hero, Alfred Russel Wallace, who was a contemporary of Darwin's. And so we go to this island and he meets this so-called Raja. He's only Raja of a little bit of the island. He's bought some land from the Sultan of Brunei and he tries to rule over it. But the thing that connects him to Jane is that he has a kind of a feeling, an expectation that life is asking something more of him than what he's got. And this expectation has brought him to this place, and he's built a rather magnificent house. But unlike many of the white Rajas in the Malay Peninsula at this time, here is somebody who actually really wants to do good. But it's very difficult for him to do good because he has no knowledge of the place. He has no kind of innate knowledge. He's an incomer. And so he relies on his male lover, who is quite a powerful character, to tell him what to do. And his expectations are endlessly thwarted, like, in a sense, you know, what Jane wants to do is thwarted. In the case of Sir Ralph, it's thwarted by nature itself, which keeps on encroaching on the roads that he wants to build, the things that he wants to set up. He's balked by disease, he's balked by incomers, he's balked by all kinds of things. So it's a different, in these two places, Bath and Borneo, there's a lot of struggle going on. Mm. But we're with people who have great tenacity, great will, great kindness, actually. And I wanted the reader to feel that even though these are literally worlds apart, that there is some kind of human connection between these two people with their aspirations.
Totally. And it's just, I mean, it's an absolutely compelling read. I you know, when they say you can't put it down, I was sort of refusing. People kept saying, well, can I get you a taxi here? And I, no, I have to go on the tube because I've got to read my book. I just, before we go, want to pick up on something. And you said they both felt that life is demanding something more of them. What more do you feel life is demanding of you? What more will you give us?
Well, I was very ill last year. I had cancer. So I don't know how much more life I've got. I'm all right at the moment, but I had pancreatic cancer. I was in Addenbrooke's Hospital for 2 months. So I'm sort of on death row. And if you're on death row, you don't know how much time you've got or what you can do in that time. The thing that I am doing is writing a new novel. I mean, since Island of Mercy, I'm writing something else, also set in Victorian times, about a foundling girl who is has a few idyllic years, sent to a foster family, and then finds herself back at the Foundling Hospital in London, where she's sexually abused. And she grows up to the age of about 16, at which point she kills the person who's abused her. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. But whether I will actually live to finish this is a moot question.
Oh, Rose, I really hope that you do. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Rose Tremaine's Islands of Mercy is published by Chatto and Windus. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer Court. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.